This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
For Master Dogen's fascicle, refrain from unwholesome action. Moved by what is spoken and heard, unsurpassable enlightenment, you vow to refrain from unwholesome action and practice refraining from unwholesome action. When we hear the Dharma, when we encounter the Dharma, and we are moved, we can think of this as a kind of subtle communication, an intimate contact. It's not information that's being conveyed. Ultimately, it's not in the language. Something happens deep within us. Why are we moved in that moment and not another? Why are we moved and not the person next to us? In practice, particularly during more intensive periods of practice, students often have the experience to speak about moments in Zazen, in liturgy, Wariyoki, work practice. Just stepping outside, sitting downstairs, having a cup of tea. A simple moment, a moment that they've experienced many, many times before. But in that moment, they are moved. Something takes place. There can be a feeling of deep gratitude, an opening, a spaciousness of mind. There can be a sense of connection with the lineage, with the ancestors in a way that they haven't experienced before. Can take many different forms. And in so being moved, we are perhaps ready or moving towards being ready to vow to refrain from unwholesome action and to practice refraining from unwholesome action, to vow to do wholesome action and to practice doing wholesome action. We can be moved to raise Bodhi mind, to aspire to realizing Buddha wisdom, to understanding that this life is to be a benefit. The purpose of this life is to be a benefit. That the purpose of this life is to put this life into service. And in that way, when we make our lives a life of service and to be a benefit, we benefit. And we don't have to be shy about that. But it's a different kind of benefit than when it comes from a place of self-centeredness and accumulation. Practice arises from, brings us to, strengthens our faith in, and helps us to realize this very place. In a sense, what's happening in that moment of being moved is a deep inner working, which many people experience at different times. Buddhist, non-Buddhist, practicing, not practicing, having faith, not having faith, in which we encounter something that we don't wholly understand. But in that moment, there's a sense of authenticity, of truthfulness that is tangible. And those moments are bringing us into contact with an unteachable truth. And we can be then moved to have trust in that, faith in that. And through practice, to actually enter into that realm, where that's not just a kind of accidental moment, or what we might call a moment of grace in another tradition, but it's something we understand. It's something we're moving within. It's something we're living in the midst of. And so in a sense, that moment we could think of as a call from deep within. Dogen says, when we refrain from unwholesome action, the power of practice is immediately actualized, made real. This is actualized on the scale of the entire earth, the entire universe, all time, all dharmas. This is the scale of refrain from. And so in the same way, we could think of that in that moment that it is actualized, in that moment of practice, that is being actualized, that we may realize or we may not, but it's being actualized nonetheless, that in fact the scale of that moment is all-encompassing, all-inclusive. Another way of thinking of that is that in that moment, the entire earth, the entire universe, all time, all dharmas are calling to us. When Dogen says to advance the self to realize the 10,000 things is delusion, that's true. And sometimes that's how we need to practice. And in that, it moves beyond delusion. And then there is a practice of allowing the 10,000 things to advance and realize the self. So in a deeper sense, all of practice is making ourselves vulnerable, exposed to the entire earth, the universe, all time, all dharmas, so that they can advance. Of course, that's just a matter of speaking. But in those moments where something enters, it's as though something enters. The spring breeze, the sun, being served by another Sangha member. And when most of us begin practicing, it seems, you know, I think a lot of us have the sense, you know, I feel this is my suffering, this is my disease, my life, this is what I want to, the direction I want to be moving in. In a way, there's a scale, but the scale is fairly contained, fairly limited. And what Dogen is saying is that scale actually is very large, is unlimited, boundless. We can think of how Zazen itself unfolds, that in the beginning everything is, you know, very contained. It's this body, it's this breath. And even that which is very present can seem kind of small and weak and dim and distant. And what happens with practice is that as the mind settles and that distance begins to fall away, is we begin to enter into or begin to realize what is always present is that scale of what actually is sitting on this seat. And along the way, of course, we have to see into our own impulses, our desires, our inclinations towards what is unwholesome, what is not skillful, and what binds, what harms, what confuses us, and to begin to unbind ourselves, or rather, unbind that mind, those beings in our mind, to examine our karma. And to see how this construction, these mental constructions have come to be. And that doesn't unbind them, that doesn't help us to directly encounter the fundamental truth, but it helps us to understand it's a construction. And that helps us to sort of not conflate, as we spoke about yesterday, action with person. When I act badly, I am bad. When I act good, I am good. When I have a thought, I am this thought. This is my thought. And so we begin to see our own patterns, but if we're really studying, we also begin to see larger patterns, karmic patterns, that this mind is not just the result of my own thoughts. We can trace them back to friends, to family, to school, to past relationships, to all of the different experiences we've had that have communicated, have influenced, have taught us, have given us identities in which we have created identities. But we all, and so we're seeing both our, in a sense, our personal karma, but we're also seeing that it's much larger than that. So the karma too, in a sense, is on the scale of the entire earth. It's our responsibility in terms of how we practice this body and mind. But the karma that we're experiencing is not solely our responsibility. And in that very same sense, the karma of other people's is not solely theirs, it's ours too. And hopefully we can also see those aspects of our life that have also offered us support and love and confidence and courage, opportunities. And so practicing within a Sangha, we're developing this scale of understanding and views in which we're able to see into this moment as well as to all of time. We're able to see into this body and mind as well as the bodies and minds of others, and others being not just people, but institutions, governments, histories. And in formal training, you know, part of the power, particularly in our practice, in our training, and different Buddhist traditions, you know, train differently in terms of how practice occurs, what different practices, but also when people gather together in a sangha, how practice occurs within that community. In our training, an important aspect of it is that we really move as one body through the day. We wake up together, we meet at the coffee service together, we come in to sit together, we walk together, we work together all through the day. And so there's this, often this solitude, this solitary, this turning inward, practicing this mind, examining this karma, and doing that together with the Sangha, which is a very, very profound thing. And one of the things that makes that particularly powerful is that we're training together. And one aspect of that is that everybody, you know, we don't stop you at the door and say, okay, what's your story? Right? And depending on your story, you get to go hear your story, you go over there. Everybody comes in with a story, stories, lifetimes of stories. And in those are accomplishments, backgrounds, experiences, histories, successes, failures. And so everybody who comes in, we practice, we hope everybody's given a seat, we sit in the same place. And so someone who has had little wealth, little material opportunity, little education, little world experience, little social benefits, is practicing alongside people who've had, who may have had very different experiences in life. And we're practicing following the same schedule, doing the same zazen, chanting the same sutras, being served the same meal. And so within our particular, right, we're practicing, trying to practice equally. And in order to do that, in order to encourage that, because each person arrives from their own place, and to gain trust to be able to do that, right? Each person also has to be met as an individual, right? And so Dokusan, face-to-face teaching, you know, this is a rather labor-intensive training, if you haven't noticed. And not just your labor, right? It takes a lot of energy. I've told this story about many years ago, talking to a well-known teacher who was here. She'd had a sangha, residential community, for various reasons. It had ended. She was here teaching. We were having a conversation. And I said, you know, so what's up? What are you going to do? And she says, I don't know. I said, are you going to have another, start another residential sangha? And she goes, oh, I don't know. She goes, I really don't know. I probably will. Because she knew how powerful it is. She knew the possibilities that creates, and she knew the work, the effort. And that's because each person is individual. This is, you know, Dada Roshi used to talk a lot about the sausage factory. You know, you just throw a bunch of stuff in and it all comes out, you know, every link looks the same. Can't be like that, right? And so there has to be face-to-face. There has to be, we have to do this in person. We have to have contact. We need to be in the same physical space. And to try and provide, create fertile conditions so that each person can practice it as much as possible, being treated equally and within their own particular place. And this is based on the enlightenment of the Buddha. I and all creatures enter the way at the same time. One mind, one Buddha nature. All beings throughout space and time have Buddha nature. I think of the precept, see the perfection, do not speak of others' errors and faults. Do not speak of, do not dwell in, do not create a sense of separateness, a sense of permanence, a sense of self with the perception of other people's differences. Do not confuse an action with their personhood. Do not create personhood within an action. And so to see the perfection is a practice of non-discriminating consciousness. It's a realization of the self-nature of every person. And this is practice, this is zazen. Everything that arises in our mind arises out of discriminating consciousness. And the practice is to bring to that non-discriminating consciousness, to bring forth the mind of enlightenment within delusion. And so in the poem by Hong Zhu, he says, the Lancet of Seated Meditation, which you find in the Fascicle by Dogen, same name. Hong Zhu says, the essential function of all the Buddhas, functioning essence of all the ancestors. It knows without touching things. It illumines without facing objects. Knowing without touching things, its knowledge is inherently subtle. Illumining without facing objects, its illumination is inherently mysterious. To know without touching. This is Zazen. To be cultivating non-discriminating consciousness in the presence of discrimination. To be practicing equally within a field of inequality is our aspiration. And just as it's difficult to realize this fully in Zazen, it's difficult to realize this fully within a community. But having faith in this truth, we can be moved to commit ourselves to it. I vow to see the perfection of all beings. When I speak of others' errors and faults, I will do so only out of compassion and reverence for life. I will take no joy in that. It doesn't make me feel better to see another's troubles. I don't use that to lift myself up. I will constantly be aware of and take responsibility for the ways in which I use perceived differences to bring forth beliefs in inherent quality, self, superiority, inferiority. Our minds are trained to perceive differences as part of how we navigate our world. Our society tells us what those differences mean, how to interpret them, which creates the sense of self, inherent qualities, superiority, inferiority, dukkha. And because of that, because our mind naturally sees differences, called prejudice, and we're conditioned to react in different ways, to act upon those perceived differences, which is discrimination, and that happens generation after generation, eon after eon, in particular ways within particular places. I vow to see the perfection, to speak of others' errors and faults in our thoughts, words, and actions. If we don't notice, if we aren't moved to practice that, then it will continue without our apparent trying, without our noticing. And in that, it will continue to seem to confirm those biased views. Just in the same way that if we don't practice, if we don't engage the Dharma, if we're not moved to practice, then our delusion continues to perform, to continues to unfold itself. It seems without trying. Right? So when you speak and I get angry, I'm not aware of trying to get angry. It seemed to just happen, which is why it takes so much effort to see how much effort is going into creating that anger. Sometimes in that moment, but certainly in all the previous moments. And so it takes not only being moved and a commitment and a vow, but a sustained effort to liberate ourselves. And so while we aspire to train equally without anyone being favored or held back, it's not possible, right? It's not possible to fully do that until everyone is fully liberated. And so along the way, as we are moving towards our full liberation all together, right? That means we are practicing equally with inequality, within ourselves and within each other. And in our aspiration to create an enlightened society, on our way to that, right, we also have to take responsibility for the ways in which we are practicing within an unenlightened society. Delusion and enlightenment are one. They arise together. They must be practiced together. And so in the inclusion statement, when we say we are committed as a Sangha to creating a practice environment in which every individual is recognized as possessing a fundamental dignity. And because of this, is to be treated with respect. And so we have to examine what is dignity? What is respect? Each individual has the right to practice in an atmosphere in which he or she feels safe and free from any form of discrimination. That is our aspiration. That is our commitment. And with every vow that we make, we're making that vow because we have not yet realized it. We're not yet living that. That's why we take those vows. We practice because we're not always practicing. That's how it works. Right? In the moment when we are always practicing, you're not practicing anymore. In the moment when we're fully liberated, we're not liberated. That dissolves, falls away. And so in the values of the Beyond Fear of Differences group has brought forth to the Sangha, there's the value of equity. To create just outcomes, we recognize that different treatment, including reparations, is sometimes required because of historical oppression and our varying positions in contemporary society. And so, you know, and as I've said before, these values are also just our values for an enlightened Sangha. And each of them, as with all, you know, the precepts and our vows, we can turn them outward and practice them outwardly in our relatedness, and we also turn them inward. And so with these values, we can do the same thing. And so outwardly, we're moving into the realm of the many beings. Moving inwardly, we're moving into the realm of the many beings in our mind. And reparations in our country in every country in which reparations is an issue, is a very charged thing. Right? So I want to read just a few lines from this remarkable piece of writing, I think, by Ta-Nehisi Coates, The Case for Reparations. He says, "We invoke the words of Jefferson and Lincoln because they say something about our legacy and our traditions. We do this because we recognize our links to the past, at least when they flatter us. Those words speak to who we want to be, in the same way that our vows speak to how we want to be, but they're not fully realized." He says, goes on to say, "But Black history doesn't flatter American democracy. It chastens it." He said, within the Black community, there's the perception that something unmentionable about America that integrationists don't acknowledge is that white supremacy, the notion that people who have white skin are superior, is not merely the work of hot-headed demagogues or a matter of false consciousness, but a force so fundamental to America that it's difficult to imagine this country without it. To contemplate that. It's difficult to imagine the United States of America without the force of the idea that having white skin puts white people in a superior role. And so what does that do to the narrative that we want to believe about ourselves, that all people are created equal, that everyone has an inalienable right? Even though even in the wording of those words, it wasn't all people, not by a long shot. And as we spoke about yesterday, you know, it's like when we confront difficult things about ourselves, difficult views, difficult beliefs, difficult actions, part of the reason, you know, why do we suppress things? Why do we deny them? It's not just because they're painful. It's because I don't want to be that person. That doesn't conform with who I want to be. And in a sense, that's a good thing. Right? The way I want to see myself is as somebody who is more enlightened, right? That's not a bad thing, but how am I using that desire? How am I using that aspiration? When the way I'm using it is to suppress those aspects of me that are not that, the ways in which that vow is not realized, then I move myself further away from the possibility of realizing my life as that aspiration. I make myself more impotent, more distant from that reality. And so Coates says, and so we must imagine a new country. And so as practitioners, it's like, it's not that now, I mean, in a sense, aspiration is imagining ourselves in the beginning as a Buddha, right? Well, so how do you do that? Well, so here's one, right? Here's just a representation of one. There was a living person that this image represents. But more importantly, because we're not aspiring to be someone else, I hope, we're aspiring to the enlightenment of this person. We're aspiring to the enlightened view, the enlightened actions, the enlightened being of this person. And so in a way, we are trying to imagine ourselves, which is really, from a Buddhist perspective, you know, not a false thing, but it's like recognizing that's already there. In other words, that what, for instance, imagine a new country means what we need to be what we aspire to fulfill those original words, is already here. And so he says, and so we must imagine a new country, reparations, by which I mean the full acceptance of our collective biography and its consequences, is the price we must pay to see ourselves squarely. You know, yesterday I spoke about the power of seeing the Dharma affirmed, spoken, in a sense, by non-Buddhists in other realms, speaking about other things. Coates isn't talking about Buddhism. As far as I know, he's not a Buddhist. Right? But what he's saying, can you not see that in terms of, if you turn that in terms of your own understanding of what practice is? We have to fully accept our collective biography, the story of, right, my identity, my sense of self, and its consequences. And so we have the Gatha of Atonement, we do Fusatsu, we have our precepts, we have vows, we have practices in order to do that, so we can see ourselves squarely as we are. So we can see ourselves squarely. He says the recovering alcoholic may well have to live with their illness for the rest of their life. You may well have to live with your delusion for the rest of your life. But what does that mean as you are liberating yourself from that delusion? He says, but at least he's not living a drunken lie. Reparations beckon us to reject the intoxication of hubris and see America as it is, the work of fallible humans. It's like, oh, I can work there, right? That sounds like a place we could work. He says, what is needed is an airing of family secrets, a settling of old ghosts. What is needed is a healing of the American psyche and the banishment of white guilt. What I'm talking about is a national reckoning that would lead to spiritual renewal. And it's interesting how frequently in talking about the largest issues in our country, and you hear different speakers who are not Buddhists, and I don't know what their spirituality is, but there's some sense, as coaches point to, as people have referred to, you know, in terms of working with climate change, that somehow, and sometimes I get the sense that they may not even know how. In other words, they may not have actually worked that out themselves, but there's some sense that there is at the heart of this, it's a spiritual matter. As practitioners, we should get that. We should understand that. And so that's how, you know, working, and I understand, you know, in the forums that we did recently and the questions that were asked and that we've been reading through those and want to come back and be responding to some of those questions because they're good questions and they will help all of us understand and clarify more what are we doing? What is practice today for us? And so some of those have to do with, you know, politicizing the Dharma. And I get that. You know, one aspect of it, I think, is, you know, wanting to be able to come here as a refuge. You know, being so immersed in the concerns of the world and the craziness of the world and the many voices of the world, you know, and wanting some refuge from that. And that is a primary responsibility that we have, that this place is. And because there aren't many places like this in terms of being a monastery, a living residential community, a Dharma community, and so on. A place where people can make their lives. And so that is extremely important. You know, and that is a balance. I've talked about that tension. And yet that question of, you know, is this political, you know, raises the question of what is political? What does that mean? And so when we recognize that however we've defined political, right, is in your consciousness, it's in my consciousness, we have been raised within those realms and all of the different ways they express themselves and exert influence. And we've experienced those influences differently. Some of us have benefited, some of us have not. That's in us. So when we sit down to study the self, what is this self we're studying? Right? Can we compartmentalize? I'm just going to work on my spiritual self. Right? That's what the Dharma is about. How would you separate it out? Those words are just ways of focusing on different aspects which have truth, but really they're all pointing to the same thing. You. One mind, one body. And so recognizing that we're striving to practice as one body, right? To see the perfection, to not speak of others' errors and faults, to not reify highs and lows, to create just outcomes, to make that more possible, we recognize a different treatment. Within this field of equality, there is inequality, and so different treatment is, including reparations, is sometimes required because of historical oppression, because of our karma, because of how we got here today, and how that results in our varying positions in contemporary society. And so to see the perfection, to not speak of others' errors and faults, is to not abide within the ideas of inherent characteristics, inherent qualities that get attached to a person, to a group, to ourselves, and to not project them onto ourselves or onto others. So when Dogen says, do not think that to face a person is to understand a person. So when I stand before you, do I see you or am I seeing my mind projecting itself onto you? Almost certainly, both. Do not think that not to face a person is not to understand a person. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. To not face a person means that first we must not face ourselves. In order to not face ourselves, first we have to face ourselves. In order to be free, and in the language of Buddhism, to go beyond, we have to face. We have to go into. We have to stand on, in a sense, that ground of equality. I am not this, but here this is. I'm not you, but here you are. And face that, which means face its characteristics, its qualities, right? And to face my projections, my stories, my narratives about it, and to study that, to see the mental construction, to see the creation, to see the consequences of that, and to begin to release. Not only release myself, but release my projections. Release that emotion arising. Release you from my projections, from my constructions. And that's what we call going beyond. It's not around, it's not over, it's not high, it's not low. It's entering into realizing mind, all beings are one essence. Awakening compassion, nothing is forsaken. None of these differences, none of these beings. It knows without touching, it illumines without facing. And as we face more and more clearly, it becomes more and more intimate until there's no longer facing. A student asked Master Yunmen, what is the teaching of an entire lifetime? And Yunmen said, teaching facing oneness. And so to create just outcomes, to work for the benefit of all beings, means meeting ourselves and meeting each other where we stand. And in that, to bring forth skillfulness. And so in a sense, in a very real sense, training is everybody steps forward. And so we don't meet you at the door, we don't ask you your story, but we also don't say, what would you like for breakfast? What time would you like to get up? Right? When would you like a shower? Right? We don't ask those questions either. And so there is renunciation, right? There is letting go, practicing letting go of those preferences. And then there's also the recognition that within those fields of differences, some of those distinctions, some of those differences have to be met and treated differently. The ground upon which we stand is not the same, and it's not different. We illuminate delusion to reveal the whole. Dogen says, this very person at this very moment abides in the place and comes from and goes to the place where no unwholesome action is created. No unwholesome action is created, although the person appears to be faced with the conditions of creating unwholesome action. Or they may be, no unwholesome action is created, although the person is experiencing unwholesome action being brought upon themselves. That's the realization of this is Prajnaparamita, is the merging of all dualities. And so to see without touching, to illumine without tampering, we have to see closely, and then closer still, and then closer still. Each and every person completely fulfills their own virtue. That is never given, it cannot be received, it can't be taken away by any person, by any society, and we live in different places. To be committed to alleviating suffering for all beings means to study the self of this body and mind, the self of others' bodies and minds, the self of this place and time, the place of this karma. You know, yesterday I said when we don't attend, there's, you know, the basic sort of practice of the Dharma is that we meet what is in front of us. One action arises, you practice that action. Because the reason it's arising now is because it's alive. And in that aliveness, you're at a pivot moment. It's arising because of karma. And in that moment, we have the opportunity, if this is a positive thing, to move it more positively, to strengthen it, to affirm it. If it's not helpful, it's a pivot moment in which that can shift. When we don't practice that which arises, it doesn't go away, right? It's arising and not being attended to gets stronger. It's not being attended to gets stronger. And the strength of that becomes integrated in our being and fuels and validates those cycles that are the individual and large cycles that create suffering at all levels. And so I think of the monk who came here from Japan who met with Daido, and when Daido Roshi said, what is your practice? The monk said, yes. To let that be our practice. This that arises, yes. It's like when the call to the Dokusan line is called and you hesitate for whatever reason, yes, just go. And then you find out. To free one's body and mind and those of others means to free all beings in the mind, in your mind, in my mind, and to care about every being in their body and mind. Within the one body of the Sangha, each and every one. When, I think it was Tungshan, was leaving his teacher said, what did he say? He said, I'm going to have to just paraphrase this. He said, be meticulous and fulfill your vows. And Tungshan said, I understand how to be meticulous, but how do I fulfill my vows? And the master said, don't disregard a single one.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.